After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
I thought if there was one thing that I could focus on, it would be psychedelic literacy. That if we could pull one lever that would help us to address and adapt to our current context and situation, it would be amplifying the power of psychedelics to not only heal, but transform our relationship with our environment. And in that, help us to create a new paradigm that instead of being rooted in separation, extractiveness, argumentative divisiveness, instead it's rooted in interconnectedness.
This is Mind Rolling. I'm Raghu with my buddy Gauguin, who's done a couple of things with me in recent times, and we got Paul Austin. Paul, welcome to the show.
Yeah,
we were just playing around because I didn't submit a list of questions. Someone just said that to me to be on their podcast. Really, I haven't ever done that. So we're just winging it, but it's not that difficult because Paul has a wonderful book called Mastering Microdose, and we're going to talk about that and psychedelics and the culture around it. And we met up at MAPS, I guess it's a few weeks or a month ago in Denver, which is the organization that's been doing a lot of the research work to prove how the efficacy of psychedelics in general. Well, particularly MDMA and psilocybin with PTSD and in use in other therapies, including death and dying and addiction. So, yeah.
And just to add into that, you know, the unplanned podcast with just menage a trois here, you know, when Paul and I first met actually was a few years ago, and talk about a chaotic podcast. I think we had what, like 9 different men from the psychedelic world that we came together and did something called Entrepedelics. Paul, can I talk a little bit about what that little retreat we did? You
want in Boulder Creek in the Santa Cruz Mountains? I would love to just that was 5 years ago last month, and we had it was 2018 July 2018, and we had quite a crew. Michael Costuros, who is an executive coach who has been leading entrepreneurs and ayahuasca retreats. My good buddy Tim Sekou, who has led over 20 ayahuasca retreats through a company called One Heart. Tommy Lorsch, who's an Argentinian entrepreneur in the digital marketing space, who's become an investor. Omi, who I think you know or knew quite well. And myself and you. Was there anyone else that was present with us?
No, that sounds about right. And we definitely did not have a list of questions. It was kind of podcast soup about the nexus of psychedelics and entrepreneurs and thinking about how we can, I mean, because we talk a lot here about, you know, the potential of psychedelics to, you know, move to more of a shared vantage point, build, you know, compassion, integrate that into our lives to be better humans. It was really interesting to focus on entrepreneurs and leadership and how we can be more conscious leaders and lead more, you know, compassionately, build more conscious companies, and utilize psychedelics both. I mean, Paul representing more of the microdosing side of that, probably myself and some others representing a little bit more of the journey work or more heroic or threshold doses to have breakthroughs.
I love what you all call it, more heroic. And I think back to when, you know, late 60s, and I go, we weren't thinking anything. What do you got? Pop, boom. We had no idea. And, you know, and the mic, in terms of LSD, I mean, those doses were hundreds of micrograms, whereas not quite that these days. So yeah, well, there was no such heroic time.
No such thing as microdosing, right? So even concept of macrodosing, microdosing, back in the day, it was just take a thumbprint of acid and see what happens.
Yeah, right. Fun time. Hey, Paul, why don't you just talk about, you know, where you come from and you know, and just in reading your story a little bit, I think it's really efficacious for you to talk about your Calvinistic upbringing, shall you say.
Yeah, West Michigan, just to root a little bit, the city of Grand Rapids, I grew up outside of, a city of about 200,000 people.
Kellogg's, and right?
Kellogg is in Battle Creek, about an hour south of there.
Yeah.
So Grand Rapids is best known for furniture. So Steelcase, Herman Miller, Haworth became the furniture capital of the world in the 19th century because of all the timber that was coming down from the Upper Peninsula. And, you know, the Dutch, all of the poor Dutch peasants settled Michigan and Iowa. And so I was really raised in a religious Calvinist environment. Now, both of my parents were quite progressive, quite liberal. So it wasn't what a lot of folks would consider to be conservative or fundamentalist, but it was very much, you know, morality, good and bad, was determined by what we were learning in church. And I was at church for 4 hours every Sunday. And then when I was 16, my parents found out that I had been smoking weed. And so my dad sits me down after church one Sunday. My dad's a beautiful man, very kind man, sits me down and says, I haven't been this disappointed since my brother passed away in a car accident 25 years prior, right? And so the conditioning that, you know, had contextualized my parents' relationship with cannabis, with illegal drugs, you know, really was the just say no era. And yet at that time, I felt, it doesn't feel like I'm doing anything wrong. Like I'm having very, you know, novel, fun, enlightening experiences, even with cannabis at that point in time. And so that just continued to set me down this journey of rebellion, right? Like my parents feel this way, I feel that way. And a few years later, I, with that same friend who introduced me to cannabis, found my way to psilocybin and LSD. And at the age of 19, just had these beautiful, awe-inspiring experiences with psychedelics. And at that point, I'd become quite atheist. So I was raised very religious, never really bought into it, became quite atheist. And then I started to work with psychedelics intentionally at the age of 19 and 20. And that reopened for me this beauty of what spirituality is. And it gave me some insight as to how the church came about, how Christianity came about, but also helped me to understand that it had become dogmatic, that it had become ossified, that it had become too rigid and structured. And so that just set me down a path of, you know, I think the core thing, if I could communicate one, it's like what came about from that was this relationship and connection to nature. And that the more we take care of the environment, it takes care of us. And as a man who was really attempting to clarify, what is it that I want to do with my life? What is my mission? I thought if there was one thing that I could focus on, it would be psychedelic literacy. That if we could pull one lever that would help us to address and adapt to our current context and situation, it would be amplifying the power of psychedelics to not only heal, but transform our relationship with our environment. And in that, help us to create a new paradigm that instead of being rooted in separation, extractiveness, you know, argumentative divisiveness, instead it's rooted in interconnectedness, the concept of things as together. And so that just, you know, really has informed my entire, I would say, life path and career with third wave and psychedelics and all of that.
Right. Amazing. It's great to get that early on, right? That did happen to me, and I know it happened to Gauguin as well. Really knew what it was we should be doing here and just got into that flow. So you do talk about the 60s, and early 70s, you know, when the culture really shifted. And of course, psychedelics had a huge part of that, as well as the people like Ram Dass and Alan Watts bringing over to a very large audience these incredible teachings that came from the mystic traditions of the East. We've had a lot of blowback, though, about how we supposedly, I don't know what the right word is, related to, like I just said, hey, we weren't thinking anything. I mean, until, you know, Leary and Alpert came up with Set and Setting, you know, it was, hey, somebody had something. I mean, I'd be, you know, in at the Carousel Ballroom. I don't know how many people. Do you guys know what the Carousel Ballroom was in San Francisco in 1966, yeah. 7, 8, 9? No.
Yeah, I was born 15 years later.
So oh, I see.
Probably after that.
Okay, well, you know Bill Graham. We probably know who
sure.
he is.
Yeah.
Or was, unfortunately. And so he would be putting on, he got this auto dealership. I forget on which, it's the street that you go through downtown to get over the Golden Gate. I can't remember what the name of it is. But it was up, he took over the whole building. And so it had this huge, huge space. And it eventually became Winterland. And he moved it elsewhere. But at that time, it was called the Carousel Ballroom. And I think he was involved with the Dead in the Airplane as well in it. Mm. We used to go down there every weekend. We never looked to see who was playing. It was just a ritual. We would go down there every weekend. You know, and Janis and The Who. One night I went there, The Who was debuting. Tommy, you know, had come over from England to, you know, just crazy shit like that. But what was going on there in terms of psychedelics was literally, hey, here you go, tongue out. And that was a reality for us. And that until, you know, we got a little bit more acquainted with it, we started to understand that it was much more efficacious if we were going to do this within some kind of structure, set and setting, that allowed us to take advantage of its insights, basically, although we did not call it that then. And then fast forward to really understanding it when I went to India, when Ram Dass went back the second time, and he gave our guru, Neem Karoli Baba, if you read Be Here Now, The Man in the Blanket, mm-hmm. he put, you know, some white lightning on and gave him a few tabs of white lightning, which I later found out really are about 700-800 micrograms. I found out it who knew that? The guy that got busted, who is giving a talk at MAPS in Denver. Were you there, Gagan? He had just gotten out of jail. God, I can't remember his name. He was a major, major distributor of acid.
Leonard Pickard? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, Leonard.
Oh, Leonard Pickard.
Yeah. And he actually knew what that dose of white lightning was. And it was
really?
Six. Yeah, he said, I'm thinking, shit, Maharaji took three or four of those at once. Nothing happened, but he said, look, this is great for beginners. It allows you to have what he called be in the presence of Christ for a few hours, but then you got to leave. Ultimately, better to love everyone, feed them. That'll get you where you want to go. But it gave us the idea of how this had opened up a whole doorway. In fact, and Ram Dass said this many times, I would not have been able to grok or to completely have an affinity for anything of what this human was that was beyond, you know, polarity and duality. We had never experienced anything like that without acid, without psychedelics. So, yes, we were a little messy back then, but it gets dismissed in a way that I find short thinking. What do you all think about that in terms of what went on there and the experimentations we did and what's going on now?
Well, I'd let Paul jump in on that because that's really, I think, why he started his company and what he's done. I mean, I'd love for you to talk about what, you know, third wave and the reason, like, because I don't think a lot of this audience maybe hasn't even heard why the name, which I love, but also how you've cleaned up that messiness. It would be great to hear from you.
Yeah, there's a lot of threads here to pull on. So we could probably dedicate an entire podcast conversation to just impressions of the 60s, lessons learned that have been integrated, you know, from the 60s, what went super well and what didn't go so well. And, you know, how do we discern truth from fiction? Even because a lot of the framing around the 60s is also rooted in propaganda from a government that has, you know, been against peace and against consciousness and against many other things. So there's a lot of sort of chaos and confusion in that. And I, you know, whenever I reflect on this, there's a few things that come up. One is when we look at our lineage from a Western lens with these plant medicines, in many ways, we've been cut off from psychedelics for 1700 years, right? Ever since the Eleusinian mysteries were eliminated by the Christian church when it became the official religion of the Roman Empire. So for over 1700 years, we really haven't had an integrated ritual where we, who come from a more Western background, have intentionally worked with psychedelics. So of course, when LSD comes on the scene, in the 50s and 60s, there's this remembrance of how incredible and how beautiful these experiences can be. But also, there's no lineage, there's no tradition, there's no ritual, there's no sort of cultural skill set to navigate and deal with the chaos that can come forth. And that's, of course, why in the Eleusinian mysteries, you know, it was once or twice or three times in your life, you could not speak to anyone about that experience. It was reserved for the people who were quote unquote ready for it, who could navigate and handle the intensity of what that experience brought up. And it was in some ways known about and integrated into wider culture. Whereas in the 60s, LSD comes on the scene. It's a semi-synthetic, it's very potent. You know, it's in the midst and the context of the Vietnam War, of the race riots, of a lot of other things that are happening. And so even when there was this guy Ehrlichman, who was asked why they made certain drugs illegal. And, you know, he said, we knew these drugs weren't harmful. You know, speaking about LSD and cannabis in particular, but we could not make, you know, being a hippie illegal. We couldn't make protesting being illegal, but we could make the drugs that the hippies and the protesters were using illegal.
John,
right? And so, exactly. So there's definitely that element and that lens. And I think another aspect here is, you know, we have certain technology these days, which in many ways has been catalyzed through psychedelics, right? There's a really interesting relationship between psychedelics and the computer revolution, you know, and how a lot of the early pioneers in the computer revolution with the internet, with the computer. I mean, Steve Jobs is well known, but there were many others who also worked with psychedelics. Stuart Brand is another one who has talked about this. And right, so that relationship, it's almost like the internet was invented as a result of psychedelics. After we had these experiences with psychedelics feeling so interconnected, the question was, how do we build an external technology that can actually facilitate this for us on a widespread basis? And so I think we're much better equipped now because of the way that education has been democratized. I mean, this is why I started Third Wave in the first place. Was back in the day, Third Wave started in 2015, whenever I would type in a psychedelic, LSD or mushrooms or whatever it is, it would always be the sort of anti-drug propaganda websites that would be at the top, you know? And I was like, how do we actually fix this through SEO by giving factual, objective information about these different substances? And then the way that microdosing, I understood for it to fit in, and this is where Jim Fadiman talking about microdosing, amplifying it, I think was so beautiful. There, it's my belief, and Terence McKenna thought this as well, and Timothy Leary and many others, that these high doses of psychedelics may only be best for the hardcore psychonauts, and that lower doses may be ideal for, let's say, a mainstream population that just wants to feel a little bit better. They want to have a little bit more energy. They want to, you know, have the relationships be a little bit better, but they don't necessarily need a paradigm shifting experience to happen. And so I think the very fact that now there's this middle way, I almost see microdosing as a middle way where you don't have to do 5 grams of mushrooms to have an experience at psychedelics. You can do these lower doses and still benefit from it. And I think that that shift in perspective is allowing a lot of people to engage with psychedelics that previously would have been too intimidated or too scared because of some of these horror stories that came out of the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. Okay, don't blame us so much, though. I mean, we were just hippies.
Right.
But look what happened, you know, and many people coming out of that culture, Stuart Brand, as you just mentioned, being one of them, you know, and what enormous contributions, jobs, and all of it.
Huge.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And even in our little group that happened over there with Ram Dass, which is really only a few hundred people, which when I look back at that, that's extraordinary in and of itself. You know, many of those people went on to really make, you know, significant contributions in one way or another. So,
well, and now we have elders, right? We have elders who are around in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Whereas when this first came on the scene and the, you know, we didn't have any elders, we had no lineage, we had no people to help kind of usher this in. And so it's almost like that had to happen for us to be where we are today. There's almost, there's, you know, a divine perfection in the way that this has flowed. And even, you know, there was so much beauty that came from that and lessons learned that now have been integrated and that are allowing for the current psychedelic renaissance to really, I think, take form.
Yeah. And I love the connection to indigenous culture,
right,
and what that really means and how we need to look to that, those cultures in relation to what's going on, obviously, with our ecosystem, with our polarity, with all of it. And I love how you point out some of the really ancient stuff. I mean, some of it was like 35,000 years ago, there was something found that showed the use of entheogens. Yeah.
Yeah, the stoned ape theory from Terence McKenna that our ancestors... Our ancestors ate mushrooms on the savannah grasslands of Africa. But even in more modern times, right? Like we think of ayahuasca, or we think of wachuma, or we think of iboga, right? Many of these indigenous plant medicines have rooting and lineage. But what we often forget is even with something like LSD, it has a rooting, it has a lineage. LSD is made from ergot, a fungus that grows on rye bread. Ergot is the same substance that was found in kukion, which is the beverage that the ancient Greeks drank in the Eleusinian mystery. So I think it's also important to honor that we as a Western populace have lost our indigenous rootings. We've been completely uprooted from it because of Christianity for the most part. And before that, the Romans. And so a lot of what psychedelics are bringing us back into, it's a remembrance of that wild, primal, animist, shamanic aspect of ourselves that has been conditioned out of us, that, you know, we've lost touch with in this, you know, focus on progress and technology and, you know, all these sort of like, I think, immature leanings of a culture that's still quite young and trying to figure itself out.
More commonly known as greed and power.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing too, when you think about, I mean, at that MAPS conference, Stamets was talking about just getting back from Egypt and seeing, you know, mushrooms in the hieroglyphs. Was a fascinating talk that he gave. I mean, the cows used to go down to the Nile, their blue lotus there. They used to go and eat those. And of course, the mushrooms were growing out of the dung. And Cleopatra was then, high society, Egypt, was eating those mushrooms and then sharing it with, you know, her lovers, Mark Antony and others from other high society that around that time. It's it was fascinating. But what really, when you start talking about there's the indigenous humans that were here in that first wave, but there's also just the original mother. I mean, there is the intelligence of planet of this planet in just its, all she wants to do is birth life and take care of it. Mm-hmm. And so some of this plant medicine, which has been, you know, ostracized from society for so long, it's been here for us to help us remember, you know, to help us take care of each other, to get out of what, you know, I think Raghu, I forget who even coined it now, but that movie of me, and move towards the more interconnected view, and more of a shared vantage point. I mean, that's the gift of for instance, psilocybin, or, you know, what I've seen in my own experience is, and it's why I'm kind of drawn more towards the plants that you spoke to, you know, wachuma, ayahuasca, cannabis, psilocybin. But I'm curious, in your, now in this third wave, because I know you've really done a lot of work around specifically LSD microdosing. Mm-hmm. Curious how you pull those apart and why you've been drawn to LSD microdosing. You know, whereas others, you know, are kind of speaking a lot to ketamine or psilocybin or others.
MDMA.
I mean, part of that is my own personal experiences. You know, the most profound experiences that I had at a young age were on higher doses of LSD in nature, in the woods, outside with small groups of friends. Mm. Right. So there was definitely an element of my own personal experiences have been so influential in terms of how I move in the world and why I love it. And that's because I tend to be a more melancholic person. And so LSD is a more uplifting. It's an antidepressant in many ways. It has this, you know, sense of bliss that comes from it. And that's because LSD is more dopaminergic. There's more dopamine with LSD than something with psilocybin. I think another reason I focus so much on LSD was because it's the most controversial, right? It has the most stigma associated with it. And so if we can get culture to reframe the relationship with LSD, then things like psilocybin, ayahuasca, wachuma, that's no problem. Because LSD is really the one that holds the most cultural baggage and that holds the most stigma. So it's like, you know, it's like, take on the biggest one first, go for that, and then help to reframe it by educating people that you don't need to do a thumbprint of LSD in order to benefit from it. You can just take a tiny, tiny dose that's barely perceptible. And so it just flips the perception totally on its head. And then I think the other element for me has been the audience that I'm speaking to and that I really want to communicate to are entrepreneurs, high performers, creatives. And I find generally that psilocybin, now ayahuasca is interesting, and that I feel like it's a whole other thing. So psilocybin versus LSD, just to keep it a little contained now, psilocybin is more serotonergic. There's more serotonin. So serotonin is tied to contentment. And I find that a lot of people who are doing inner work, trauma healing, healing aspects of their body and their past, psilocybin can be really, really good for that. But for those who are really looking for like cognitive improvement, that are looking for creativity, that are looking to access flow more, a little bit more easy, I find LSD to be a better tool specifically for that. And so since I'm speaking to that audience, I mean, I'm speaking to a lot of people, but I love that audience in particular. It felt like LSD was a good neurochemical key for precisely what it is that they were interested in. And it also, just to come back to the point that I was making before, it has the most lineage for us as a Western people. Right? Psilocybin is historically with the Mazatec. I mean, it's all over the place. As you mentioned, Paul Stamets in Egypt, but the Mazatec are known. Ayahuasca is very South American. Wachuma is very South American. Peyote is from the native people here in the United States. Iboga is Gabon. But LSD, there's a particular relationship that we as a Western culture have. And it's so sad and unfortunate that it became tainted in the 60s, largely because of misunderstandings. And so I think healing that relationship with a medicine that we've known for 4,000 or 5,000 years as a Western people is going to help relieve this amnesia that we struggle with. Because I think a lot of our challenges it is the sense we've forgotten. We've forgotten who we are. We've forgotten where we come from. We've forgotten why we are here. And what often psychedelics do is they help us to remember that. Mm-hmm. And that, as Raghu was saying, that it can be the opening on the path. It was for Ram Dass. It was for Jack Kornfield. It was for, Timothy Leary. It was for so many people. And as we all know, right, it's one thing to see the mountaintop. It's another thing to every day walk towards that mountaintop. And that's where, of course, meditation and breath work and yoga and all these other practices are just as, if not more important, as psychedelics, as ayahuasca, wachuma, mushrooms. Yeah.
I want to talk more about that in terms of this is something Gauguin and I have been working on behalf of Love, Serve, Remember Foundation in terms of representing, like we did at MAPS. We did a couple of different presentations. They were not about anything whatsoever to do with therapy, PTSD, and how it, which was the centerpiece, of course, of what MAPS is doing. It was more about how to represent what Ram Dass, how he used to frame it. And basically that was our connectivity back then. But you just triggered something in me when you said healing relationships, basically, in a few less words. I had an experience that, I've told this many times on the podcast, but since this is new probably to you, it'd be interesting. When I went to India, and of course I was with Neem Karoli Baba, and then my father wrote and said, I want to come over. I'd written him, this is, you can't believe what's happening to us. And he came over to India, which blew my mind because I had a horrible relationship with him. We fought all the time. I knew there was love, but basically we just did not get along. Anyhow, the bottom line is, after some time, Neem Karoli Baba looked at me and said, did you give your father the medicine? I said, yeah. He had a cold. I gave him some aspirin. He said, the yogi medicine Ram Dass gave me? I went, acid? And my father went, LSD? And he said, take care of your father while he's in India and meet me in a couple of weeks in this other city. And we went to where Benares, which is the city in India where people have been going to die for thousands and thousands of years on the banks of the Ganges River. And we were in a houseboat right downstream from there. And a friend of mine gave me a hit of acid. He actually took it. And he, because he was a World War II bomber pilot, who most of his squadron died. He was so PTSD'd, it wasn't funny. I mean, and of course, I was a bit of the recipient of this in my earlier days. Anyhow, he took and had a death trip from one end to the other. People dead in the streets, putting money to give him enough wood and animal. I mean, it was just incredible. We came again to see Neem Karoli Baba, who never said a word about it because there was no rational kind of stuff going on, but told him a whole thing about that nobody else could know about a horse farm and a horse that he saved in Canada. And from that point on, we had a relationship. Previous to that, we didn't. So I am living proof of the healing capacity of this incredible substance. But now we have to get into, of course, talk about having someone there to be there for whatever it was that we needed. Me as an individual, I didn't take any in that moment, and my father. Of course, we had this extraordinary being, but, there's a lot of trust. I just want to say, so people hear this kind of thing, especially this story of, I can't tell you how many people, I wish my father would take some acid, boy, we could get along, Well, it ain't that easy. And what it takes is, first of all, having yourself straightened out a little bit. And that has to happen with, and if you're using ethnogens, if you're using acid or psilocybin or MDMA, whatever it is, have a trusted friend as part of this situation. Please, don't even think about it unless that's existent. So I had that particular experience, which changed my life.
A trusted friend is great. A trip sitter, someone who you know, someone who maybe you've known for some time. You know, there are a lot of trained and certified therapists, practitioners, coaches, you know, and I think another interesting dynamic that's arisen in this third wave of psychedelics is, you know, do you have to be a psychotherapist in order to guide someone into their deepest sense of being? And there are a lot of indigenous facilitators and practitioners who have no such credentials and yet have been doing this. And their parents and their parents' parents and their parents' parents' parents have been doing this for a very long time. And I think what you've hit on, Raghu, is important. It's we don't necessarily need doctors and psychiatrists and clinical therapists and psychologists. They're helpful. Absolutely, they're helpful. But really what psychedelics are teaching us is the importance of presence, how to listen, how to slow down, right? They're helping to sort of take us out of this rigmarole, this hamster wheel of existence, and see that another way of being is actually possible. And really what's required more than anything is just a loving, compassionate presence.
Yeah, absolutely. 1,000,000,000%. And yeah. Gauguin, you know about this. I mean, you have so much experience with people in terms of journeying and ceremonially and so on. It's just that, no?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, when you were talking about how this got stigma, you know, through marketing, I mean, LSD, it's like I was thinking about somewhere in high school when someone said, oh, if you take more than 7 hits, you're clinically insane. And I was like, well, I'm no mathematician, but I think maybe insane 50 times over. I am curious because, I mean, this is your business now. I mean, this really trip sitting, as you put it, and training coaches how to be there as people are kind of moving along on their journey. I'm interested at this cross section of that with microdosing in particular. So I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about that, because I have heard a lot about, you know, when you're moving into those more threshold kind of doses, but in a microdosing capacity, I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit more about what that program's like.
So about 2 years ago, I noticed that there were a lot of programs that were starting to come on the scene. And what you're speaking to are like practitioner programs for coaches, for clinicians, for therapists who want to help clients to prepare and integrate, right? There's some programs who also train guides, facilitators, but guiding an actual experience, it is a similar, but not the same skill set as assessing, preparing, integrating for an experience. And what I noticed is that a lot of those programs were specifically for clinical indications, PTSD, depression, addiction, alcoholism, you know, very trauma-informed, mostly for clinical therapists or clinical psychologists. And yet the work that we had been doing for so long was really looking at not clinical healing, but transformation and the betterment of the well. And so I was like, how do we develop a training program that's for executive coaches, that's for health and relationship or health and wellness coaches, life and relationship coaches, and some clinicians who want to expand outside of the sick care model, specifically mm-hmm. the fix it model. And as I was talking about this with a few friends, we landed on, you know, really looking at psychedelics as a skill that we as practitioners first have to learn ourselves. So I think what's really important from an ethical and integrity perspective in the psychedelic space is anyone that you work with, let's say a guide, a therapist, a coach, should have walked that path themselves before they guide you down it. And that's because there's a lot of unknown and uncertainty when you're taking, you know, mushrooms or LSD or ayahuasca. And so we really rooted the training program in walk the walk. And then as you walk the walk, have support, have accountability, we have some frameworks, and then you'll be much better equipped to then help others walk that walk as well. And so the frame that we put around it is psychedelics are a skill. And there are really three key elements to that skill. The higher doses, how do we set up a really beneficial high dose experience, if that is aligned and what the client is looking for. The role of microdosing, sub-threshold, right? Low dosing, what's the role of that? And then contemplative practices like meditation and yoga. And how do those three together, how can a coach weave a client through those three elements for healing and for transformation? Mm. And so what we train our coaches in is understanding the broadest landscape possible. So it's not like we go deep into just psilocybin microdosing or go deep into just LSD microdosing. We have modules on safety and ethics. We have modules on the difference between a guide, a sitter, a therapist, and a shaman. We have modules on the difference, you know, the different medicines, ayahuasca versus psilocybin versus LSD. And where we really focus a lot of our time and energy is what we call the practicum. Because I think theory is great, but we need less here and more here, right? And so for any training program, it's, again, walk that walk. So we have a six-month practicum that we put all of our practitioners through, which teaches them, how do you assess clients? How do you help clients prepare? How do you help them find the right experience, right? Whether it's ketamine, whether it's a low dose of psilocybin, whether it's breath work, whether it's ayahuasca, how do you help them find that right experience for where they're at and what their intention is? How do you help them integrate after that experience? And what's the role specifically of microdosing in that integration? And so instead of just focusing explicitly only on the sub-threshold dose or the microdosing, we really have that broader landscape. We focus a lot on microdosing as a tool potentially for preparation and certainly as a tool for integration. But I do think that there's a lot of benefits that don't necessarily come from just sub-threshold experiences, right? There's an incredible amount of research on the value of a mystical experience, on the value of a high-dose experience. And I think what's important to emphasize is the quality of that experience is really determined by the quality of the facilitator, the practitioner, the center, how safe someone feels, if it's the right medicine for them, whether or not they're on any psychiatric medications. There's so many variables. Yeah. To navigate. And so also ensuring that all of our practitioners understand what are all these variables? And most importantly, what can you do? Meaning, what are you equipped and trained to facilitate? And what is out of your range? Because I think the biggest risk in this sort of third wave of psychedelics is the sort of case of the Instagram shaman who ends up facilitating 5-MeO-DMT for someone that really should not be doing this whatsoever. It creates a psychotic break. It re-traumatizes the individual. It's highly unethical. So I think humility really has to be instrumental in any training program for practitioners. And of course, the greatest teacher for humility, at least in my life, has been love and mushrooms and ayahuasca.
I think Ram Dass might agree with you there. He said, "Trust the mushrooms." I'm curious. Just one thread you hit on there that I'm actually very interested in. Like Raghu said, we were doing a number of talks, and some of it was about how to integrate that spiritual experience that you may have on psychedelics into your day-to-day life to, you know, be a better human, more compassionate human. So on the microdosing side of that, I'm curious about kind of the microdosing spirituality, you know, like that side of psychedelics, which is hard. It's not as tangible, you know, as like the, yes, if you, you're going to see these performance enhancements, you know, around creativity or energy. We live in that age, right? Where it's, there's that performance enhancement side of microdosing, and there's kind of the cumulative effect of healing past trauma. Mm-hmm. But then there's this other part of psychedelics, which is the divine. You know, that touching that divine experience. And I'm curious if that's also integrated in to, you know, these kind of microdosing programs, like how you touch on some of that.
And I think that goes back to what we've talked a lot about, which is this indigenous rooting and lineage. And of course, what's central to indigenous practices with plant medicines is ritual, ceremony, reverence, you know, recognizing and seeing the intelligence in the thing that we are working with. So rather, you know, I think the downside or the dark side of microdosing is it just becomes commodified, like Prozac or Zoloft or Xanax, right? Hey, take this pill. You take it without giving it a second thought in the morning, see how it feels, you know, see you later. I think what's critical is that there is space that's created. So let's say you're waking up in the morning, you're going to start your microdosing protocol. You know, you might hold the microdose. You might say a prayer. You might have a ritual with it, you know, where you meditate with the microdose. You may set an intention with it. So I think having some level of presence with that tool, some level of intention is really quite critical, because you're not going to have the big mystical experience, the big transcendence, the big aha. And, you know, as I forget who said this, both of you will know this, you know, before enlightenment, you chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, you chop wood, carry water. I think what microdosing does, it's after we have these transcendent experiences with high doses of psychedelics, it just makes it a little bit easier to chop wood and carry water on a day-to-day basis. Gratitude is easier to come by. You have a little bit more energy physiologically. You know, it just sort of helps to keep the windshield clean, so to say, of that spiritual self.
Yeah. What's a main thing that happens in my own experience with it is more space is created to be less reactive to all of the incoming stuff that we deal with a billion times a day, with people, incidents, God knows what it is. So, you know, that's very attractive. I want to go to the practitioners who have got to be walking the walk, as you say. Mm-hmm. How much time are they, as part of the program, are they putting into the practices that are, in my mind, absolutely necessary in terms of the integration of the insights from psychedelics, I don't mean it that way, microdosing. Obviously, there's, you know, the bigger boom happens when you take a regular dose of any of these. But how are these people led into that which they can disseminate to somebody else, that there is an integration process that is not just, I mean, you even say it, it's not about getting high. It's about, you know, integrating, and Gagan talked about it being a better person, but harnessing, you say, it's tangible benefits in everyday life, vitality, connection, and creativity. That takes real intention to, and then there's many, many practices, from mindfulness to meditation to mantra practices and breath. I mean, it can go on forever, which is the beauty of the potential of the spiritual path. But yeah, that integration is extremely important, and it has to be delivered from somebody who's got the experience, right? How are you working with people that way?
And so part of this is that person who comes in, what are their practices already? Right. And so anyone who's coming into this path, almost everyone who's joining this training, you know, they've been meditating for a year or 2 years or 3 years, or, you know, they run a yoga studio, or they've been a practitioner of yoga for 5 to 7 years, or maybe they've, you know, been doing Wim Hof breathwork or transformational breathwork. So for many of them, they already have established practices. And so part of the container is a 6-day intensive in Costa Rica.
Oh, really?
So we go down to a beautiful center called Brave Earth in Costa Rica. We have a 6-day intensive. We do breath work. We do meditation. We do a high dose psilocybin ceremony. We do what I call a hiker dose, take a low dose of mushrooms and go for a nature walk, a meditative nature walk. We have workshops. We do a temescal, a sweat lodge. So there's a lot of baking that we're doing at that intensive. We're making that a very intentional experience. And then throughout the program, we ask everyone to have a practice. It could be a daily meditation practice combined with journaling, that may be breath work, that may be yoga, whatever that practice is, something that is your anchor and is your rooting as you're moving throughout this. Because some folks, let's say, you know, we have a lot of executive coaches. Those coaches, you know, are going to have a slightly different lens and frame on what practice is ideal for their context, for their set and setting. It may be journaling in the morning to clear the mind, to help them, you know, get present and ready for the clients that they're working with. A health and wellness coach, you know, their practice could be fasting once a week in conjunction with some sort of movement every day, and maybe a cold plunge and sauna as well. So it's really like, what is it that that individual needs to help with the integration process? And how do we ensure there's accountability baked into the program itself with the other classmates? Because everyone is walking this path together. And so that sort of collective accountability, I think, is instrumental to overall integration. And I think it's also why integration in modern times can be so difficult, because we go down to Costa Rica or Brazil, or, you know, we go and have a weekend retreat in Marin, and then we come back to our normal everyday life, and we're back in the same structure and the same set and setting that has caused all those triggers prior. It's why even folks who have struggled with addiction a long time, you know, you can take them out of that. They can go do something like Iboga, it heals that addiction. But if you put them right back in the same environment and context and set and setting, they're way more likely to slip back into that addiction. So yeah. I think part of the challenge is for integration, how do we actually create a new context, a new environment, so that integration feels seamless? It doesn't feel like something we have to work at necessarily. And I think when I look at the larger vision of third wave, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years from now, it's how are we seeding this new paradigm that we touched on at the very beginning of interconnectedness? And how can we actually create new systems around business, politics, education, healthcare, the way that we live, that are actually in alignment with and representative of these deep experiences that we have with psychedelics?
I think that Ram Dass's main teaching, main thrust in the last years of his life in Maui was this concept of developing in the center of your being a relationship with loving awareness. I am, and you said, I am loving awareness, or just loving awareness, meaning you're getting out of that perspective that Gauguin mentioned about the movie of me in your head, the story you tell, we tell ourselves, and you're getting into the center of your being, spiritual heart, whatever you want to call it, and breathing into a place where you are not sitting there in judgment. You are not in the crosshairs of polarity on our day-to-day basis. And that combined with what Ram Dass, when he first came back from India, called the witness. But it cannot be the witness from here. It has to be from the place where you're not in a judge mode, a judge and jury. And that loving awareness practice is crucial in my mind, because then your perspective on everything, including the kind of work that you're talking about with psychedelics, either regular dose or microdose, without that kind of mindfulness and without a perspective that you're coming from in terms of your moment-to-moment life, then it would be difficult to imagine the engagement of going back and integrating from these experiences in a way that is going to affect all of the things you just meant, from business to politics to creative arts, all of it, without that change in perspective. Just my opinion on that.
And it's almost, I think Ken Wilber mentioned this, it's how do we turn altered states into altered traits?
There.
And it feels like the frequency that we experience in these high dose experiences is that oftentimes that frequency of love, because it's the frequency of God. It's the frequency of source.
Yeah.
And so having the capacity to cultivate that and be with that is, I think, the core of integration. It's rooting in love.
Yeah. And that's what we're working on right now, trying to, you know, bring that up, because I think you even said we're talking about, everybody has trauma. There's no doubt about that. We've all gone through it to one degree or another, some more health, in a more healthful way and some not. But what we're talking about is people being able to engage in this way who just want to get more familiar with who they are truly. Just starting there. So, or people that are very dissatisfied with continuing in that story of me, just being so, you know, walking around with all that kind of self-motivation stuff and want to change that. Psychedelics can do a lot to completely transform that. It's just then, how do we integrate it after the fact?
Yeah, and with setting proper coaching, proper guide. I mean, I can't tell you, Raghu, how many people come up to me at the Ram Dass retreats, you know,
asking you to help them on.
Well, just more so curious. Like, there's been fear.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. A lot of folks, even that were hippies back in, you know, I mean, my parents were. They graduated high school in 69, you know? I think a lot of folks maybe played around a little bit then, and then the stigma took hold, and all of a sudden it became this bad drugs, you know, it's cocaine, heroin, psychedelics, all of it wrapped up in the same. And now it's interesting to see, you know, even very rational humans, that it's the U.S. government. I mean, it's the destigmatization of them that now it's saying, oh, maybe I'll try microdosing again.
Yeah. Yeah. Or just the reality of especially what Rick Doblin has done. And of course, all of the scientific research at NYU, at John Hopkins. I mean, it is changing the culture around this. It's changing the negativity. That is just a phenomenal thing. So allowing for something healthy to happen.
And just to fully land that, Cal Berkeley just did a survey, and they found that 61% of Americans support legal psychedelic assisted therapy in 2023, which is
That's amazing.
Tremendous.
Right there.
Yeah, we're actually working on with this amazing group called Treat California, Jeannie Fontana, working on this ballot proposition that would be the creation of a $6 billion government agency, government-run agency to provide this kind of help. Because that's, you know, one of the things we don't want to do is have this follow what's happened in cannabis, where it goes recreational and not medical. The path for this, in one man's opinion, it would be to, you know, medical, and done in the proper ways. But it's been a beautiful shift in culture, and we'll see a lot coming up in this next advocacy cycle and with the ballot propositions.
Yeah. So we're kind of at the end of our little chat, but there's one wonderful paragraph that I have to read from your book, Paul. Again, we have to keep putting in the caveat that anybody who has not engaged in this way, but is feeling like some connectivity to what's been discussed here, again, you. At the very least, if you bump into Paul on the street, you know, make friends with him or a Paul, and Gagan or myself or anybody that has some experience, and you know, I mean, that happened to me with Ram Dass. I met him and I trusted him, and the rest of my life was like, it's been an incredible trip. Okay, here it is. Psychedelics can help address an underlying challenge of living in modern society, the lack of human connection. These medicines remind us to be grateful for our friends, family, and the beauty of life. They deepen our empathy and help connect us with nature, spirituality, and the universe. By reducing our egos, we can concentrate on pure creation without feeling shackled by the judgment of others. There's a lot in there, and that's as true can get, Paul. I really appreciate it. Appreciate the book.
ChatGPT, what? Come on. That is beautiful, Paul.
This is pre-Chat GPT. I'll just let you know.
Right. The book is Mastering Microdosing. They'll be in Be Here Now Network Mind Rolling. Go there, and in the show notes, there'll be links to make it easier. And a link to, Paul, you'll give us a way in which people can engage with you with Third Wave, right?
Yeah, we have a private community. We have a Third Wave app. If you just go to the App Store, type in Third Wave, you can find the app. We have a lot of conversations, dialogue there. And then we have a podcast ourselves, the Psychedelic Podcast, that I've been hosting for 7 years now. Mm. And if anyone's interested in, you know, the practitioner training program, that's through the Psychedelic Coaching Institute. And if you just go on our main website, thethirdwave.co, you could find all of the details there.
Beautiful, beautiful. Great contribution, man. Really appreciate
Thank
it.
You. Really. Thank you, Raghu.
Thank you, Gogan. Thank you, guys.
For making this connection.
Yes. That's another beauty out of that incredible scene in Denver a month ago, whenever it was. This is Mind Rolling and Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and catch a bunch of incredible people, including Alan Watts, who should have been part of this conversation. Actually, he and Ram Dass had a couple of really great trips together that Ram Dass talked about. And we have a major course, Ram Dass and Alan Watts, an online course in October, and you'll all hear all about it. If you sign up to ramdass.org and put your name on the email list newsletter. Okay. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time.